back with you, wrapping up a very busy week. Friday, November 18th, 2022, on Connecticut Today, we featured State Senate GOP leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford on the latest rate hike requests from Eversource and the United Illuminating Company. We welcomed author Joel Richard Paul, his new book, Indivisible, Daniel Webster, and the Birth of American Nationalism. And I had some breaking news coverage regarding the appointment of a special counsel to further investigate former President Donald Trump. As we continue on a Friday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Now, folks, you know, I do books like this usually on Friday. It's the weekend coming up, so I like to maybe take a little breath from what's going on at the present moment. And, you know, I have a passion about history and about the Founding Fathers and all things of that matter. Our next guest is a professor of constitutional and international law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. He's written previous books, including Without Precedent, Chief Justice Marshall and His Times, and also Unlikely Allies, How a Merchant, a Playwright, and a Spy Saved the American Revolution. His new one, Indivisible, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism. Joel Richard Paul is the guest. Hey, Joel, good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
Appreciate it, Joel. You know, when I got the material for this, it right away piqued my interest, Joel, for two reasons. Well, number one, I'm a history buff. But number two, you know, the name Daniel Webster, Joel, I'm sure a lot of folks that you come in contact with in your teaching career and writing career, like, yeah, Daniel Webster, like that guy, like early country, that guy. So that piqued me, number one. And number two, the word nationalism, which today, unfortunately, has this somewhat of a negative connotation. So talk about this and maybe what a lot of people, Joel, may or may not know about Daniel Webster.
Well, Daniel Webster, first of all, was a prominent congressman and senator. He was twice Secretary of State, four times candidate for president. He was also probably the leading advocate for the Supreme Court, known as the defender of the Constitution. But what made Daniel Webster such a remarkable individual was that he was acknowledged, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, as the greatest orator of the English language. Daniel Webster had the capacity to stand up before crowds of tens of thousands of people and to speak extemporaneously for 4 to 6 hours without notes. And people would describe themselves as completely mesmerized by his words. People would say that they were transformed when they walked out. He had a remarkable influence on the early part of the 19th century in the ways in which people thought about what it meant to be an American.
So it certainly sounds like back then, Joel, pre-technology, it was the power of the spoken word that Daniel Webster really took advantage of.
Yes, he was the person who Abraham Lincoln said was his role model. Much of what we think of today as Lincoln's words are actually quotes taken from Daniel Webster. When Lincoln stands before a crowd and says that ours is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, everyone in the audience understood that Lincoln was simply quoting Daniel Webster. At the time that Daniel Webster lived, our ideas of what it meant to be an American were not yet formed. We had different competing notions of what it meant to be an American. For most Americans, they were really just citizens of their own state. Mm-hmm. They were from Connecticut. They were New Yorkers. They were Virginians. But they didn't think of themselves as Americans. And it was Daniel Webster who really put forward, he popularized the idea that the Constitution made us all Americans. And that is the idea that really shaped American nationalism leading up to the Civil War and beyond.
Joel Richard Paul is the guest, professor of constitutional and international law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, talking about his fascinating new book here, Indivisible, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism. We'll talk more with Joel coming up. First, though, a check of traffic and weather together right here on WICC. On a Friday, yes, it is Connecticut Today, and every so often, you know, I love to talk American history, politics, weaving it all in, because we are products, kids, of what came before us. And a very erudite gentleman named Daniel Webster, steeped in American history, came before us, but you may not know a whole lot about him. Name of the book, Indivisible, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism. Our guest is author and law professor Joel Richard Paul. Joel, you mentioned Webster's gift of oratory, his oratorical skills that rubbed off on so many people, including Lincoln. Did this come naturally to him, or did he work at this? Was he just a natural orator, or was there a method to what he did?
Well, as a young student at Phillips Academy in New Hampshire, he was terrified of speaking in public. And when he was called on in class to stand up and recite, he froze in terror, and he was thrown out of Phillips Academy. And he went home feeling terribly humiliated. His father had mortgaged his farm in order to pay for his schooling. So Webster goes home, and he decides that he is going to learn to be a great orator. And he basically teaches himself. He memorizes, in a single weekend, 70 passages from the Bible. He has an enormously capacious memory. And he has a great command of the English language. His speeches, which sometimes ran 60 to 70 published pages, believe me, I've read them all. They're remarkable. They read like something that Shakespeare would have written. And this all came to him somehow on the spot. So he had this capacity. And what he's doing is he's pushing back against the kind of rancid populist racism of Andrew Jackson that was so popular in the first half of the 19th century. He's back against this idea with the notion that the Constitution made us all Americans, regardless of our race, ethnicity, or region of the country.
So did a lot of the country at a time when there was basically no electronic or mass communication per se, unless you had things traveling by horse or, you know, communiques and couriers like that, did a lot of the country, Joel, did they know about Daniel Webster or not? Or were they able to read about him?
Daniel Webster was more famous than the President of the United States. The President of the United States in the 19th century could walk down the street and people wouldn't recognize him, but Daniel Webster had an extraordinary face, and his portrait was everywhere. He had a very large head and very, very large features, and these sort of burning dark eyes that people found hypnotic. Everyone in America read his speeches. His speeches were transcribed and republished in newspapers and in pamphlets all over the country. Every school child in America from the 1830s right up into the 1910s had readers that were known as the McGuffey readers, the Pierpont readers in school. Those readers excerpted parts of Webster's speeches, and school children were required to stand up and recite them from memory. And the purpose of this was to educate school children and what it meant to be an American citizen, what it meant to be an American citizen under a constitution that made us all Americans. That's the influence that Daniel Webster had.
Did he ever have a notion, or did he ever run for president? Why was he never president of the U.S., assuming that he had such great influence and was so well known and revered, as you tell us?
Well, he ran for president four times, and he was never elected president. He was known as Godlike Daniel. People said that when they heard Daniel Webster, it felt like they were hearing the voice of God. But people didn't want God to be president. They wanted someone who they could relate to. They wanted someone who, you know, they could have a beer with. And Daniel Webster was a very aloof man. He was a man who became quite controversial in the Compromise of 1850. Daniel Webster in 1850 was faced with the difficult choice of either protecting the Union from secessionists or agreeing to the Fugitive Slave Act. The Fugitive Slave Act was part of the Compromise of 1850, and Daniel Webster's decision, Daniel Webster, who had distinguished himself throughout his career as the voice of New England, as the leading opponent, as one of the leading opponents of slavery in the Congress, he had to agree to the Fugitive Slave Act in order to save the Union. He saw the Union as the vehicle for crushing slavery in the end, just as Lincoln did. So he stands up and gives a speech on the floor of Congress, known as the March 7th speech, 1850, which basically he endorses the Fugitive Slave Act as the only way of saving the Union. And he knows that this is the end of his political career. And indeed, it was the end of his political career. It was that kind of courage that was essential for saving the Union, at least from 1850 to 1860. And by postponing the Civil War for 10 years, it gave the North time to build up the military advantage it needed to crush the South and to end slavery once and for all.
Fascinating. And finally, is Daniel Webster and his works and, as you say, his pivotal role in helping to ultimately win the Civil War and abolish slavery, is that taught enough at all in school or not? I'm guessing the latter and not the former here, but you tell me.
Well, Webster's reputation was eclipsed by Lincoln, who was actually a protege of Webster. Lincoln saw himself as under the shadow of Webster. Webster made possible the success of Lincoln. But after Webster endorsed the Fugitive Slave Act, he is known as the slave catcher in chief, and his reputation was destroyed. He's been forgotten in history, which is unfortunate because I think particularly at the present moment when we have so much rancid populism once again in this country, Webster offers us a solution to the problem. And the solution to the problem is to appeal to people's better angels, to understand that the Constitution made us all Americans, regardless of our race, our ethnicity, our origins. It is the Constitution and not populism that is essential for the preservation of our democracy.
Name of the book is Indivisible, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism. We've spent a few minutes here with author Joel Richard DePaul. Joel, thank you. It's fascinating. I'm sure going to pick up the book, and I urge my listeners to as well. Thank you, sir, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
All right, and in Rob's headlines there, he mentioned that Senate leaders are not happy with this whole Eversource thing, and one of those Senate leaders who was reelected a few days ago, Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford is with us to talk about that and another initiative that was kicked off today. Kevin, it's Paul. Good afternoon, and congrats on the reelection.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's great to be back.
Yeah, you're chomping at the bit, Kevin, huh?
Yes.
Well, listen, I know the numbers are about what they were, give or take a seat or two, but I know there occasionally, Kevin, is unanimity here and cross the aisle concern of certain things in Hartford. And I guess that's what we're seeing right here, Kevin, with Eversource saying, hey, right, there's nothing we can do. So if you're an average rate payer of ours, expect to pony up another $85 a month for 5 or 6 months. What's your reaction to all this?
Well, first and foremost, a 50% increase is ridiculous given the circumstance of what Connecticut is, and that's unaffordable. We have some of the highest the highest in the continental U.S. electrical charges, and so they're asking a 50% increase on that high charge to begin with. And, you know, we've got to look at everything. There's no silver bullet here, Paul, but I think every issue has to be on the table. And we have to be objective and honest about what is the driver of the cost and when we look at energy costs. And we have to have that honest and frank conversation to make sure that the people of Connecticut don't continue to have these, you know, enormous increases. Families can't be expected to pay an extra $85 a month for electricity. That's the average person.
You know, Kevin, I bring it up every so often on the show here, and some people think it's a great idea. Some people think I'm absolutely out of my freaking mind when I say this. But, you know, Kevin, if this kept going, which I don't see any reason it wouldn't, despite the best efforts of you and your friends on the Democratic side, if this kept going for years and years and years, might we, Kevin, come to a point that, you know, some other states and municipalities have looked at saying, hey, there's profit being made on the backs of state consumers. Let's look at possibly, even though it would cost billions of dollars, do something much the way they did on Long Island, Kevin, which had massive power costs, you know, generations ago. And, you know, you had Lilco eventually taken over, and now they have the Long Island Power Authority, which isn't great, but I know friends of mine there say it's better. Could you ever envision anything like that and just operating a power utility here, Kevin, at cost and not worrying about, you know, profits for rate holders and rate profits for shareholders and all that? Or am I nuts?
Well, clearly, Paul, you're not nuts.
Okay.
What you're doing is you're looking at an issue, and that is we have, as the status quo, here the energy costs continue to increase leaps and bounds.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're one of the most expensive states for electricity. We can't continue to do that. So to me, you can't continue to do what we're doing expecting a different result.
Yeah.
We all know what that's called. So we have to look at everything on the table and put it there, because, you know, the only way you're going to fix it is by looking at the whole issue. There's no silver bullet. You need to take, I think, a holistic approach. But there are certain things we do know, like when you come to insurance, there's a lot of the same claims. Oh, the insurance companies are making millions. We don't like that. But when government endeavors to do it, like with the public option or in mm-hmm. our case, the partnership plan, we find that it doesn't work. It actually ends up being very expensive. The taxpayers end up carrying the load and the overrun. And so we have to be mindful of that, but that doesn't mean that we can't look at the status quo, study it, evaluate it, and make sure that there are changes going forward to bring the relief that Connecticut families are really demanding. And they deserve, Paul, quite frankly.
And folks who are in the Eversource power area, Eversource, the dominant power company in the state, the UI company much smaller, but Eversource has recently announced anticipated spikes in rates for at least the first 5 or 6 months, they say, of 2023. They're telling folks they will average at least $85 a month more for the average user. Now, some will pay less. Many more will pay more. What can state lawmakers do? Republican Kevin Kelly, a state Senate GOP leader from Stratford. A few more minutes with Kevin. And Kevin, did I read where the governor has said that he's going to ask you folks in the General Assembly in the House and Senate to, you know, maybe make sure that as much money is possible, if not more, that we have this surplus to set up something to compensate folks who may need help here? Do you envision any of that happening?
I certainly do hope so. It's something we've been calling for, Paul, since June. And I'm happy that the governor has decided to see to it that we're going to hopefully address this issue in special session. Just for your listeners, the low-income energy assistance program is what we're talking about.
Yeah, LIHEAP.
And
yeah.
Initially, the governor and the majority proposed a 40% cut over last year's appropriation. Then our Washington delegation got some added funds from Washington to reduce that 40% cut down to about 26%, which is where it sits today. We've been advocating to not only fully fund this, but to go above just the families that are on the low income, but actually reach up to middle middle, like $75,000, $100,000households, so that they could also experience a little bit of relief. Now, what I'm hearing among the leaders is that we're going to look at fully funding LIHEAP at what it was last year. But Paul, we already know we're having about a 12 to 15% increase in applications, as well as, you know, you see energy with regards to electricity going up by 50%. Well, you also saw the same thing with home heating oil going up 15 to 20%. So you need more than just what we paid last year, because if you did what we did last year, you're going to go under. You're not even going to tread water because you're falling behind. We need to increase it by about 25 or 30% just to tread water, and quite frankly, go above and beyond that so that, you know, people can heat their homes. Because one of the things that they've been saying is, well, this would help home heating oil, but they could always use electricity. Well, we know electricity is now going up.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be a little bit more foresighted, looking future into where Connecticut's going to be in January, February, which is, you know, a New England winter. It's probably going to be cold. So rather than take a wait-and-see attitude, we started this, like I said, in June for a reason, because we didn't want to be here without a plan. And that's what we need. And just funding it at its current level, while it's better than where it is, it's certainly not enough to meet what the demand and costs will be come January.
All right, Kevin, and also let's end on a more optimistic note here. Understand that there's something called Apprenticeship Week, and you took part in kicking that off this morning or earlier today in Meriden. What's up with that?
Well, you know, here we have one of the best labor forces in the country. The state of Connecticut is blessed with the labor and skill that we have. And this really celebrates our building trades, and in particular, their apprenticeship program. It's workforce development. It puts and delivers the skills to future tradesmen and women. And what it is it's a celebration of Connecticut labor and the good job that they do to keep our economy going and building things that, you know, we can make all the greatest plans in Hartford, but if you don't have somebody that can actually build that plan out, that plan is just a piece of paper. And we're blessed to have the good quality labor here in the state of Connecticut to do that. And basically this week celebrates that.
Excellent. Kevin, thank you. Be good. Stay warm. And we'll check in down the road. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Take care.
All right. State Senator Kevin Kelly. So there you heard it, folks. There's a push now. He said the original plan in Hartford, now get this, was to cut LIHEAP funding 40% off of what it was last year. Now, why does that happen when we have all this money, right? We hear from the governor, oh, we're flush with tax revenues. We're flush with COVID money. So the idea was to cut it, he said, by 40%. Our federal delegation got enough money to hold off that cut to 20 or 25%. And now Kevin said there's a push, I guess, by both sides of the island, Hartford and the governor, to not only fund this fully, but maybe raise the money the state can, you know, give to people to help on. I know I've had calls that say, well, you know, you can't spend on everything. But geez, you know, doesn't this make sense? Am I wrong here? Shouldn't we supplement at least some people in this state to a better extent to stay warm during the winter? So as a lot of people predicted, including your furry little host here, the former president of the U.S., Donald John Trump, maybe this now quote-unquote presidential run for 2024 is just a move to try and avoid criminal prosecution. Because remember, the Justice Department supposedly lives by this mantra, this unwritten rule that if a declared candidate is suspected of doing something, the Justice Department will not step in at all, or they will not step in within a certain amount of time up to an election. Well, and we're going to get live comments here in just a bit, courtesy of one of our news affiliates, NBC News. Merrick Garland now says he's going to appoint. What do we tell you, folks? You listen to this show, you get the straight story here. I don't just toot the horn unapologetically for the right. I don't do that. I'm a conservative, but I also have a brain. And I also look at stuff as matter-of-factly as I can. Merrick Garland's going to appoint a special counsel to figure out whether criminal charges should be filed against former President Trump in connection with two pending investigations. News of the panel was first reported by the Wall Street Journal, and it came just 3 days after Mr. Trump announced plans to run for president in 2024 while he faces multiple criminal investigations. But NBC News reporting that the special counsel, whose name has not been announced, will make decisions for two Department of Justice investigations against Mr. Trump. One is focused on whether he broke the law and obstructed justice in connection with his removal of hundreds of documents from the White House, which were shipped to his residence at the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach County, Florida. The other probe is related to the January 6th Capitol riot by a mob of Trump supporters there in D.C. So again, folks, this is, you know, nothing is accidental in politics. Nothing is, oh, look at that. Nothing is coincidental. There are no coincidences in politics. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. So now what's going to happen is, again, we're standing by for these live comments that we'll bring you via NBC News with Merrick Garland. But apparently he is going to make an announcement saying, hey, all right, I'll step back. The Justice Department will step back and we will let an independent counsel look at this. Now, obviously, supporters of Mr. Trump are not going to like this. They will find some sort of, you know, bias in whomever this independent counsel might be, whomever he or she, you know, may be. My guess is to try and get his point across. Merrick Garland is probably not going to appoint some raging leftist, I would think. I'm sorry, you know what I mean. I'm sure there are no raging, crazy leftists who could be independent counsel. But you know what I mean. Hey, you know what? As far as a touche, Merrick Garland may appoint some well-known Republican, right? Maybe he comes up with Ken Starr again. Ken Starr. Remember that during Whitewater? Remember the Archibald Cox? Remember him during, he was the guy during Watergate, I think? Now, of course, Mr. Nixon saw that he had no further support. His poll numbers were cratering into the 20s, so he stepped back. So there you go. So we're standing by for that. And again, it all parses out. Because a lot of people were saying, okay, even if Trump wants to run again, right? Nobody declares 2 years out. Nobody does that. I mean, even the people who want to run on the Democratic side, maybe to, take over from President Biden, if he decides in the end he may not be physically or mentally up for another 4 years on that side, or even those on the Republican right or the conservatives who say, listen, we're chomping at the bit now. You know, the Biden presidency has had some sputters and rumbles and we want to take over here. Nobody announces that 2 years out. They don't. You're going to start to get those announcements late 2023, early 2024. So, again, there's no real surprise here. I'm intrigued now by who or whom. That whole English thing, that whole pronoun thing, it articles, pronouns, whatever, confuses me. You know, who or whom, you know, this person might end up being. So again, a little breaking news here, and we'll keep an eye on it. Attorney General Merrick Garland set to name a special counsel in the Trump criminal probe as the plot thickens. Yes. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And again, timing is everything. So similar to how the January 6th thing was set up, and I told you, I'm not sitting up here tooting my horn all that much. But, you know, a lot of people knew that the January 6th thing was going to run out right toward the midterms, and now the report will be issued. So now the special counsel appointment, whoever that may be, whoever he or she may be, is kind of like a relay race now. They will pick up the baton from the January 6th committee and run with it on these two criminal investigations. One, the documents, and the second, the riot outside the Capitol. And now you know why. Again, see, folks, this all fits in. This all, and I'm not the only one saying this, you know, and I know a lot of you people out there, well, I don't watch the news, yeah, but you know what? The news has kind of had this right over the past few months. You know, maybe this is why that FBI raid took place. Again, none of this is accidental. None of this is accidental. The FBI raid set up the pretense for everything that falls after it. It's all a line of dominoes. It's not hard to figure out. It's kind of the way Watergate and Iran-Contra and all that played out as well. Standing by here to hear from Merrick Garland, the sitting attorney general of the U.S., in what looks to be a move by him. He's going to appoint a special counsel in two cases. The Mar-a-Lago document case, where you may remember it was a long time ago, several months ago, where we got all of our phones blowing up with messages and, you know, this, that, and the other regarding, you know, the document seizure at Mar-a-Lago. Now, it's interesting. It came out a couple of days ago, and it's a story that's not getting too much coverage, but there are sources I read inside the Justice Department saying, hey, upon further review, like we hear every Sunday and Monday and Thursday and Saturday, upon further review, what they're saying is it certainly looks like whatever classified documents that may or may not have been found at Mar-a-Lago, and maybe this has some bearing to the case Merrick Garland wants to bring now. I mean, I don't know. But it doesn't look like they were done to get any sort of a deal or a quid pro quo. All right, here's the Attorney General of the U.S. live from D.C.
connection with two ongoing criminal investigations that have received significant public attention. The first, as described in court filings in the District of Columbia, is the investigation into whether any person or entity unlawfully interfered with the transfer of power following the 2020 presidential election or the certification of the Electoral College vote held on or about January 6, 2021. The second is the ongoing investigation involving classified documents and other presidential records, as well as the possible obstruction of that investigation, referenced and described in court filings in a pending matter in the Southern District of Florida. I'm joined today by Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia Matthew Graves, and Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division Kenneth Polite. Assistant Attorney General for National Security Matthew Olson could not be here. He is currently in Germany, representing the department at the G7 Home Affairs and Security Ministerial. U.S. Attorney Graves has been ably leading the investigations into the events leading up to and on January 6. He and dozens of assistant U.S. attorneys and other prosecutors have taken on the monumental task of conducting over 900 prosecutions in defense of our democratic institutions. Criminal division prosecutors under the able leadership of Assistant Attorney General Polite have played a significant role in those prosecutions. Assistant Attorney General Olson has been ably leading the team responsible for investigating the matter involving classified documents and other presidential records, as well as the possible obstruction of that investigation. All of the career prosecutors assigned to these matters are conducting their work in the best traditions of the Department of Justice. I also want to recognize the efforts of the many FBI agents and other law enforcement personnel who are assigned to these matters. They are working courageously and steadfastly and are serving our nation honorably. I am grateful to them. We all are. The Department of Justice has long recognized that in certain extraordinary cases, it is in the public interest to appoint a special prosecutor to independently manage an investigation and prosecution. Based on recent developments, including the former president's announcement that he is a candidate for president in the next election, and the sitting president's stated intention to be a candidate as well, I have concluded that it is in the public interest to appoint a special counsel. Such an appointment underscores the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters. It also allows prosecutors and agents to continue their work expeditiously and to make decisions indisputably guided only by the facts and the law. The special counsel will conduct parts of the first investigation I just mentioned, the investigation into whether any person or entity unlawfully interfered with the transfer of power following the 2020 presidential election or with the certification of the Electoral College vote held on or about January 6. This does not include prosecutions that are currently pending in the District of Columbia or future investigations and prosecutions of individuals for offenses committed while they were physically present on the Capitol grounds on January 6. Those investigations and prosecutions will remain under the authority of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. The special counsel will also conduct the investigation involving classified documents and other presidential records, as well as the possible obstruction of that investigation. Today, I signed an order appointing Jack Smith to serve as special counsel. The order authorizes him to continue the ongoing investigation into both of the matters that I have just described and to prosecute any federal crimes that may arise from those investigations. Mr. Smith is a veteran career prosecutor. He began his prosecutorial career in 1994 as an assistant district attorney with the New York County DA's office. In 1999, he became an assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, where over the course of 9 years, he prosecuted matters ranging from gang murders of police officers to civil rights violations. From 2008 to 2010, he served with the International Criminal Court, where he supervised war crimes investigations. In 2010, Mr. Smith returned to the Justice Department to serve as chief of the Public Integrity Section, where he led a team of more than 30 prosecutors who handled public corruption and election crimes cases across the United States. In 2015, he agreed to serve as the first assistant U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee, later becoming the acting United States attorney. Most recently, Mr. Smith served as a chief prosecutor for the special court in The Hague, charged with investigating and adjudicating war crimes in Kosovo. Mr. Smith will begin his work as special counsel immediately and will be returning to the United States from The Hague. Throughout his career, Jack Smith has built a reputation as an impartial and determined prosecutor who leads teams with energy and focus to follow the facts wherever they lead. As special counsel, he will exercise independent prosecutorial judgment to decide whether charges should be brought. Although the special counsel will not be subject to the day-to-day supervision of any official of the department, he must comply with the regulations, procedures, and policies of the department. I will ensure that the special counsel receives the resources to conduct this work quickly and completely. Given the work to date and Mr. Smith's prosecutorial experience, I am confident that this appointment will not slow the completion of these investigations. The men and women who are pursuing these investigations are conducting themselves in accordance with the highest standards of professionalism. I could not be prouder of them.
All right, and there you go, the comments of Attorney General Merrick Garland talking about a special counsel to oversee the criminal investigations into President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, the documents there, and also the January 6th case. He names Jack Smith the special counsel.